Last year, the Western Australian Government released a state budget that prioritised a reduction of Indigenous incarceration rates. Its aim was to bolster the objective set out in a policy released earlier in 2019 called Our Priority, which included the goal of cutting Indigenous incarceration rates by 23% over the next decade. At the time of the announcement, Indigenous Western Australians were imprisoned at 60% above the national average. A key element to addressing the trend identified by the state government was adequate recurrent funding for legal aid services. Dennis Eggington is the CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, and he joins me now. Dennis, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
It's been a while since we've had you on the show. What's been the highlight for you since we last spoke?
I think the relationship that we've developed with the state here, the Aboriginal Legal Service, over the years hasn't been a good one, but it seems to have changed a lot. We've got a lot of new initiatives and a lot more talking and interaction with not only the police but with the Aboriginal Affairs Minister, who's the State Treasurer, and our Attorney General is on side. So as far as work's concerned, it's looking for a new building because of all these new initiatives, and things are going good.
Well, it's a good time to check in with you. The State Treasurer, as you mentioned, Ben Wyatt, made some positive funding allocations in the budget last year. From the ALS's perspective, how much has changed on the ground?
Look, I think the demand is overwhelming and something has to be done. We've got now the new custody notification service here in WA, and we looked at what was happening nationally, and New South Wales, with its big population of Aboriginal and Islander people, almost twice as many as we have in here, we're having 350 calls a week, which is about average for the Northern Territory and Queensland and other places. We're currently averaging about 600 a week. So we'll run out of money for the custody notification service well and truly before the 3 years up if we can't get some more support and help for that. And those figures that were based on what the police gave us for the previous year. So why it's almost doubled is still a question to be answered.
We also know the ALS has been working hard to get reform to the fine enforcement policy in Western Australia. Where is that currently at?
Well, it was introduced in September, late September last year. So we're here now looking at it in the upper house. It's having a little bit of a rough passage there. I think majority of politicians are wanting it to proceed. They see the merits in it as far as Aboriginal well-being, plus also the economic cost to the state. I do believe that some of the pollies that are having some trouble with it are from different parties, the Nationals and the Liberals, and I think First Nations member. But the danger for us is that if it's not through the upper house before the state goes into formal election mode, then the Liberal Party and the Nats will vote as one group of party. And if there's any kind of dissension there, then some of those Nationals and some of those Liberal Party that are actually on side may find themselves conflicted by party politics and having to not pass the legislation. So there is an urgency in it. And of course, that custody notification service I was talking about, we're still getting calls from people picked up for non-payment of fines. You know, we've been lucky enough to convince the police officers at the stations not to keep people in prison, and that's happened on several occasions, including one particular young lady who had children at home, and she was terrified that DCP would get her kids if she was given a sentence for a warrant of commitment. In that case, it turned out positive, but I do know that currently there are still some Aboriginal people in Western Australia who are receiving prison sentences for unpaid fines.
The Guardian Australia recently reported that Indigenous people in Western Australia are fined more than the average by police officers, but less than average by traffic cameras. What were your thoughts on that reporting?
When I first read it, I thought, oh my goodness, no shocks. We know this happens, you know. If you're an Aboriginal person, you get your bags checked when you go out of a shop, or you get followed by security. And if you get on a railway line over here, you can guarantee that the railway police will be there watching you. So no shocks, but I was surprised that that report had been commissioned a few years back and nothing had been done on it, because it's, if there is going to be real reform and real change, then that has to come from internally from the police department. And it's quite clear to me that that report is saying that Aboriginal people are being profiled and are being pulled over. And of course, once that happens, we do know that there's a whole range of things, that there's lots of people in a car and they're probably not wearing seatbelts and whether the car's registered. But it does mean that the fines that Aboriginal people are getting through that are much more than non-Aboriginal people. Therefore, we must be ending up in jail because of that bias or that profiling, and it should really stop. And the police have to make that commitment internally. It can't come from all of government approach. It has to be the commissioner standing up and calling it for what it is.
There's been a significant allocation for diversionary programs as an alternative to fines, and that's something that I know that you've been a very strong advocate of. How have these programs been effective to date?
Look, some of the youth engagement projects we have are really well recognised now and are working with the young people to actually keep them on track, get them to court, get them to school, get them to fulfil their bail conditions. That's happening in some of the adult areas as well. But I think some of the reforms in diversion as far as these fine defaulters are going to be very welcomed. It's going to let people who are currently in the system get out of the system and get onto the new regime. It's going to give people who are being caught up in fines the opportunity to do a whole range of programs, address their problems, whether it's a domestic violence problem, whether it's an alcohol or drug problem, or whether it's just a problem of poverty and not being able to pay fines. Some of those diversions will really work. I think Western Australia has come to a point where it's costing far too much money to the taxpayer to be putting people in prison, and people are starting to rethink the whole idea of justice reinvestment. We've got some trials happening up in Halls Creek. So there is a real effort into it. And I hope that over the few years that I've got left remaining at the ALS, that I see a big turnaround.
The last time we spoke, you expressed concerns over the future of recurrent funding for legal aid services in Western Australia. Is this still an issue?
Absolutely. We found that we've had to stop going to suburban courts. We haven't got the resources to go to specialist courts. And it's those specialist courts which really are about making changes to people's lives. We've closed some of our country offices. But on the bright side is two things. One is the state has asked us to put a submission to them regarding the gaps in services. They're very keen that where an Aboriginal person goes to court, the ALS is there. Currently, I am aware that there are some suburban courts which have, yearly figures of 600 Aboriginal people going and 300 and odd of those go unrepresented. So that's a terrible indictment on the issue of justice equality. And, of course, the other thing that I think could be a winner for us, although nationally the legal services have said they want a standalone ILAP, the federal government is promising an increase in funding if we go across to what they're calling the NLAP, and that is after the 5 years the Commonwealth will hand over the total funding of legal services to the states and territories. But in the meantime, on 1st of July of this year, the states and territories will get that money from the feds and divvy it up, and they are promising us an increase in that funding level. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed. All things are looking pretty positive at the moment, except once again, I don't think there's been enough work on the relationship between First Nations and settler society to really get people out there thinking about what's happening to us.
Dennis, nationally, focus has been on a voice to parliament, but many states are also looking at a treaty process. From your perspective, what do you think the benefits are potentially of a treaty?
Look, I think people have to get ready for treaty. So it's not actually the treaty that is going to be the best benefit, because if there is a treaty and it's done properly and we learn from mistakes like Waitangi and other areas around the world, then it will be a very, very positive thing as well. And it's only right that we have a treaty, because to me a treaty is a peace deal, and we haven't had a peace deal. But it's the process of getting ready for treaty, I think, which is really important. It's about building your nationhood, building legitimacy in your leadership, managing and controlling your own institutions that form that polity, that governance. I think Those are the benefits of it, I think, that if you have got a government structure that is culturally right for your particular First Nations, and the leadership comes from the people for the people, and it's leadership that can take that nationhood or that nation forward, I think they're the good things about moving towards treaty. Getting the words right and how that relationship is codified within a treaty is important, but I do see the ability to be ready for a treaty as being a really important part of the process. I think a voice to government is just a waste of people's time. I really do believe that the government should say to all of us, mob, get your nationhood ready for treaty, because treaty's coming.
Dennis, as you say, you've thought a lot about the importance of nations representing themselves and building their own capacity to make decisions and engage in processes with government. You've also been through both the ATSIC period and the time in which the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples was an active voice. What are your thoughts on what needs to be considered in terms of providing a national framework for representation for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across Australia, given how strongly you are advocating around the concept of nation building?
Look, I think a couple of things. I see them all as being a part of a progression forward, and we all know the gap that was left when ATSIC went, and it was a shame. I mean, ATSIC were doing some wonderful work both nationally, regionally, internationally as well. I mean, ATSIC was represented over in Geneva and at New York, the two Indigenous forums. And, of course, there was the ability to have regional councils and engage with people locally. I think it was our regional council here in Perth that was going to put some money into creating a building for the Noongar Nation, and unfortunately ATSIC was then divided off from the funding body and that didn't happen. But, you know, those community grants where families were able to access and use that monies to go out and do men's camps and women's camps and take people back to country to look after country and go out onto your own family runs or your tribal country. Look, I remember those days and, you know, 30 or 40 four-wheel drives going down and really building strength of family through fathers and sons and uncles and nephews. And those were wonderful days, but they weren't about the thing that is being denied us, which is not in any legislation, and that is the right to self-govern. And that's an inherent First Nations person's right. It's the right to govern ourselves, being self-governing. And I think that for each and every one of us, there may be similarities, but it will be different. The way that we govern ourselves will be different. The Maru people in WA will be different from the Noongar people in the southwest. But collectively, we should be able to work a system out that gives us representation to a National Congress of Australia's First Peoples. Now, I know that that sounds like the Congress, but Congress wasn't that. Congress wasn't about building nationhoods, and it wasn't about the recognition of being self-governing, but it did have things in it that were about that. It called itself that name. And on the applications to be a member, every single application that I saw, and I saw thousands, had someone identifying within their First Nation group. So I see these things like ATSIC Congress as progressing the debate and the discussion on how best for the government to get us ready for treaty. And I think then that once we're up and strong, once we've got our self-governing nations in place, we'll work out a system. I can't even tell you what they all look like, but I know that that's the right thing to do, because that's our right. That's the only thing that's being denied us at the moment, this right to be self-governing. And once we work that out, we'll be able to sit at a table and say, this is our national representative, Congress to the nation. And I'm positive of that, Larissa.
Conversations, as you say, Dennis, have progressed, and the Uluru Statement also, I guess, reset the national conversation. But at the same time, we've also talked tonight about racial profiling by police. We've talked about overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. To what extent, in terms of these debates changing the conversation, these conversations that have sort of changed what we're talking about in terms of treaty and representation, made a difference to the way that Aboriginal people are experiencing racism in their everyday lives?
Look, I don't think it's made much change at all, but there won't be any change at all if we don't rethink the relationship and the inherent rights that we do have The reality is that we've still got a colonial impost on us, and that colonial impost does not have the interests of First Nations people. It still has the interests of settler society, and that conflict and conquest can never be really dealt with unless our interests are as equal as anyone else's interest. Then it will take generations of Australians growing up with that as a part of their understanding, a part of the narrative of this country. And I think that in time to come, that those changes around those terrible things that we just talked about will change. They change with the demographics of Australia changing. You talk to people coming from countries that have been invaded, whether it was by the Spanish or the Portuguese or the English, and they fully understand the situation that Aboriginal people find themselves in. People have to understand that the attitude that's created through discrimination and racism has got a definite causal pathways to our little 10-year-old, 12-year-old and teenage kids committing suicide. People just don't see that, but hopefully in a few generations with a change in the relationship with us being seen as being equal partners in the managing and running of this country and the ability to manage and run our own affairs, Australia can't do anything other than change.
Finally tonight, I was wondering if you could reflect for us on, I guess, a more positive note. What have been the most positive changes that you've seen during your time working in Indigenous affairs?
Look, I think once again, and not wanting to harp too much on the issue around our communities and collectives, I think that there has been a real rethinking among our own community. And when people are talking, the Yamadji people up north had a land deal, and it was under the banner of the Yamadji Nation. And, I hear people in Mardu country who are talking about the ability to get their children away from welfare and away from government institutions and back with them. That need to be independent and manage and run our affairs, because that's the only way we can make changes, has been a very positive move. And remember, we went from basically wanting citizenship rights and being able to swim in the same swimming pools to jumping onto the world stage and trying to get a head around what are First Nations rights. And, the role of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is now having a major effect. When I hear government wanting to make changes about heritage laws, which are about free and prior consent, and all of these things that show me that we've moved beyond a debate around being equal, but it's more about inherent First Nations rights. That's one thing. I think that a generation, two generations, three generations of people coming into this country who aren't of that settler society stock, although their interests are still diminished in relationship to the interest and the maintaining of power by colonial interests, they understand and they're changing the political nature of this country. And I think that's another positive. And of course, our younger generation coming through are showing me that they're more compassionate, they're more ready and open for learning. I go into a lot of schools and universities, and our younger people, that's the average Australian, is coming through with a different attitude. And those three things will get us over the line, I think.
Dennis, it's always a privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us on Speaking Out tonight.
Always a pleasure. I look forward to the next time.
Dennis Eggington is the CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia.